From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Ukraine today as Russian troops settle into Ukraine's Crimea region. Washington has denounced Russia's invasion. Russia's leader, Vladimir Putin, says in Moscow today that he could go further, considering all options for a broader swath of Ukraine. This hour, On Point, what the U.S. should do or not do about Russia and Ukraine. On Sunday, before he flew to Ukraine, Secretary of State John Kerry was harsh in his denunciation of what's going on there.
What has already happened is a brazen act of aggression in violation of international law, in violation of the UN Charter, in violation of the Helsinki Final Act, in violation of the 1997 Ukraine-Russia basing agreement. Russia has engaged in a military act of aggression against another country, and it has huge risks, George. It's a 19th century act in the 21st century.
A 19th century style military act of aggression, said the U.S. Secretary of State on Sunday. The next day, Monday, President Obama, with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, said there would be consequences if Russia went further.
We are examining a whole series of steps, economic, diplomatic, that will isolate Russia and will have a negative impact on Russia's economy and its status in the world.
But the Russian leader, Vladimir Putin, saying today in Moscow they're not taking anything off the table.
If we see that this lawfulness, this disorder starts in eastern regions, we will use all means to protect those citizens. And we believe that it's absolutely legitimate. And the last resort.
We're looking in this hour at what the U.S. should do and not do here. Let's go first to Ukraine, to Crimea and Sevastopol, where Margaret Coker is covering events for the Wall Street Journal. Margaret, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome, Tom.
Sevastopol is where you've got, of course, the huge Russian naval base. Do you see evidence there of the increased Russian military presence in the streets?
Well, I think for several days now, there has been a definitive Russian military presence in the streets, and it's a bit bewildering for the local population here. It is a military town. There are two very big naval bases. One is the Russian base, of course. The Ukrainians also have their own naval base here. And according to the treaty between the two countries, the Russian military maneuvers are not supposed to be taking place without prior agreement with the Ukrainian government. So over the last few days, when you've had Russian military trucks, supply trucks, troop movement trucks, and things like that, they have been going all over the Crimea for the last over the weekend, and just between two towns today where I've been traveling, I've gone through two different checkpoints that have been set up by armed men who don't have any insignia on their sleeves, on their military uniforms. They're standing next to trucks with clear Russian military license plates on them. So the Russians have sort of come out from the shadows. They are here on the streets, and it's sort of tense here for sure.
Margaret, we have reports we've seen at a number of Ukrainian military sites around Crimea, Russian troops surrounding those sites. What about the Ukrainian naval base there in Sevastopol?
Well, there's a variety of bases here. You do have the Navy base, as I said. There's a air base that's just outside of town as well. And there was a small conflict, sort of a conflagration there this morning that thank goodness didn't turn nasty. I mean, we've had days now where the professional Ukrainian military forces have been prevented from either going to work or leaving their work to go home because they're surrounded by Russian troops. And what happened this morning was that apparently a group of Ukrainian airmen tried to get onto their airbase in order to do their technical jobs or just the general maintenance work that they have to do for whatever it is inside the base. And the Russians who were standing guard and keeping them from moving in, they shot their guns out above everyone's head as a warning sign because, you know, a group of Ukrainians in Ukrainian military uniforms isn't a welcome sight right now.
Margaret, you've just come to Crimea, to Sevastopol, from Kiev, capital of all Ukraine. Can you describe the difference in atmosphere and attitude between these two locations that you've witnessed?
Yeah, there really is a great a deal of difference. I mean, here in Crimea, you feel like you are much farther away from the world's news. I mean, the people that I've spoken to on the streets in different cities over the last day, you know, one of the reasons why they're tense is that they feel like two great powers, Kiev, Moscow, and add in whatever other European capital you want to in that equation, that other people of other countries are trying to decide their fate for them. You know, the Crimeans are very proud and have had a very long now history of this semi-autonomy. And they're sick of bad government, they're sick of corruption, and they don't think that Moscow is going to do a much better job than Kiev has done in terms of you know, helping increase their standard of living and help giving them more jobs. So right now, people, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, I don't have a scientific poll in front of me, but my straw poll on the street is that Crimeans would like to have more independence for Crimea, not to come under the shadow of Moscow, and they'd like to see a more responsive government in Kiev. And in Kiev, that's what the people on the streets that have brought down the previous regime, you know, that's what they want as well. But the distance between here and in Kiev, it does feel like there is a separation of sorts, I mean, geographic separation of sorts. And the people in Kiev want to make the new government there are looking to make the country better. But a lot of Ukrainians, not just the people here in Kiev, have heard that before and are tired of promises not being fulfilled.
Vladimir Putin saying today in Moscow, Margaret, that this isn't an invasion, that there aren't Russian troops there. In Kiev, in the capital of Ukraine, do they feel that Ukraine has do they say we've been invaded?
Yes, they definitely have. I've been, you know, in for the last 3 days, I was in the Maidan, the Independence Square in Kiev. You know, there are signs everywhere, and the general feeling is that Putin, specifically Russia, of course, is that's the flag he waves. But people are blaming Putin for this. Putin has invaded. Putin is acting like an imperialist, and this is all Putin's fault. Putin is the one bringing us to the brink of war. I had an interview with the Ukrainian Prime Minister in Kiev yesterday, and he called Putin down to the mat. He's the one that the Ukrainians are blaming for all of this. So yes, there's a feeling that there's an invasion. Even here in Crimea, you know, there's not a sense that it's a local self-defense force that's out on the streets. Like Putin in Moscow said today, the Crimeans feel like they're a bit under siege.
Margaret Coker with The Wall Street Journal in Sevastopol, Ukraine. Thank you very much, Margaret, for joining us. Let me turn to Kiev now. With U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, Indira Lakshmanan joins us, senior correspondent for Bloomberg News. Indira Lakshmanan, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
What is John Kerry saying so far in Ukraine? What's he offering? How's he describing what's going on?
Well, the main message since he landed here has been one of support. I think the point of John Kerry's trip here today is to underscore the U.S. support for the fledgling Ukrainian government that is obviously under pressure from Vladimir Putin's Russia, and also to put out a message of the concrete elements of that support. And what that consists of is the announcement of guarantees for up to $1 billion in loans that would come from international financial institutions such as the IMF, but the U.S. is offering to back those loans. Furthermore, the U.S. has offered technical support from the Treasury Department for things such as advice on market pressures and reducing dependence on gas subsidies that had been coming from Russia, and also help in recovering so-called stolen assets. So that's the kind of support that the U.S. has offered, in addition to help with election monitors and training of observers who could come and, you know, bring up to standard a free and fair election for the Ukrainians in late May.
Indira, Vladimir Putin is saying today that he was reserving the right to use further force in eastern Ukraine beyond Crimea if he decides that's necessary. Is John Kerry threatening or talking sanctions against Russia in Kiev today?
Absolutely. U.S. officials told us on the plane over here that sanctions are currently being prepared by the United States and could be ready within a matter of days if Putin does not back down, does not return troops to their barracks. And when we asked whether the U.S. would accept the annexation of Crimea by Russia and let it go at that if Putin were not to go further into western Ukraine. We were told absolutely not. The U.S. would consider the annexation to be an act of war, that this is an incursion into the territorial integrity of a sovereign state. And so the U.S. is standing firm on this and saying that, you know, we could see a variety of things from visa and asset bans that would affect Russian individuals as well as institutions. So the main point is they're trying to put out the threat. We've already seen a variety of things the U.S. has done, from cutting off talks towards the U.S.-Russia bilateral and investment treaty, also suspending U.S.-Russian military ties and suspending preparations for the G8 summit that was supposed to be happening in Sochi, Russia in June. So there have been a number of steps, and they're ramping up towards the possibility of sanctions if Russia does not back down from its current position.
Everybody will be hanging on every word of John Kerry as he speaks in Ukraine on the same day that Vladimir Putin speaking in Moscow. Indira Lakshmanan with Bloomberg News is with the U.S. Secretary of State in Kiev. Indira, thank you for joining us for a couple of minutes today. Good luck with your reporting there.
Thanks so much, Tom. Take care.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what the U.S. should do or not do about Russia and Ukraine. Secretary of State John Kerry in Ukraine today. Vladimir Putin talking about all this in Moscow, saying, no, no, this is not an invasion. They're not even Russian troops, but reserving their all options, he said, to go deeper into Ukraine if he decided that was necessary. This is creating a lot of tension around the world and tension in Washington over how the U.S. has handled all this. Here was Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina on Sunday lashing out at President Obama's handling of the whole state of affairs on CNN's State of the Union with Candy Crowley.
Stop going on television and trying to threaten thugs and dictators. It is not your strong suit. Every time the president goes on national television and threatens Putin or anyone like Putin, everybody's eyes roll, including mine. We have a weak and indecisive president that invites aggression. President Obama needs to do something. How about this? Suspend Russian membership in the G8 and the G20 at least for a year.
Sanctions being planned right now, we're told. John Kerry in Ukraine today on Sunday on Face the Nation. He described the U.S., the role of the U.S. He hopes the U.S. will play in resolving all this 21st century style, he said.
This can be resolved. We're prepared to mediate, to help. We're prepared to provide economic assistance of a major sort. We want the Congress to join us in providing that assistance. We hope that that this can be resolved according to the standards of the 21st century.
But how to do that? Russia's president, Vladimir Putin, saying those aren't even Russian troops, and those big military exercises right next door on the border, oh, those had nothing to do with the situation in Ukraine.
The military exercises had nothing to do with the situation in Ukraine. That exercise has been planned much, much earlier. Of course, it was not announced.
Joining me now from Washington is David Ignatius, foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post. David, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
And with us from Stanford, California, Corey Shockey, research fellow at the Hoover Institution. She was a senior advisor on foreign and defense policy to the 2008 McCain-Palin presidential campaign, worked under George W. Bush on the National Security Council, and as deputy director for policy planning in the State Department. Corey Shockey, welcome back to On Point to you as well.
Thank you.
What do you make of the Obama administration's response so far to what's going on in Ukraine, Corey Shockey?
Well, I think Secretary Kerry's been terrific. I think he's right to call the Russians out for behavior that's in violation of treaties that they signed and in violation of international standards that they claim to uphold in other cases. I think he's exactly right to go to Kiev and not only show our support for the government, but also outline a series of measures that will help make the elections coming up in May something that can help the Ukrainians coalesce around a new government rather than fracture.
David Ignatius, how muscular a role do you think the United States ought to be playing here? Ukraine's right next door to Russia with long, long historic ties. On the other hand, here we see all these troops in there, and it's shocking. What ought Washington's posture to be?
Well, this is a genuinely dangerous crisis, and bad outcomes will be averted to the extent that all parties understand that the United States has interests, is militarily strong, and is resolved in its policy. I think there are three essential pieces of good policy here. The first, which was mentioned just a moment ago, it's important to consolidate the change that's taken place over the last few weeks in Ukraine. The Ukrainian people have risen up, have in effect expelled a pro-Russian government of Viktor Yanukovych, and I'm glad to see Secretary Kerry there today with measures that will help them get ready for elections, deal with their severe economic problems, and also deal with corruption. One of Ukraine's biggest nightmares is that it in some ways has become an oligarch state. So part of what Secretary Kerry brought was technical assistance in dealing with issues of corruption. Second thing the U.S. has to do is prepare sensible measures that will make Russia pay a cost if it continues with its policy of aggression. I think it's more important to get those set on the ground than to talk noisily about them, but it's clear that Secretary Kerry is getting that preparation work done for economic sanctions, for diplomatic sanctions, for essentially scuttling the G8 summit that Putin had planned. And the third thing I would cite is to leave some door open, some off-ramp, as people have been saying, for Putin to climb down from his illegal, brazen actions, as Secretary Kerry has described them, and stabilize the crisis. That's not to say that he's necessarily going to do it, but I think it's important not to close that door, to leave him some opening room. So I'd say when you look at the substance of what U.S. policy has been over the last week, the basic elements of good policy are there. I've been surprised at the degree of sharp, sometimes even shrill, criticism of the president personally from some Republicans. I don't think that really helps. And it's surprising when Putin invades another country that a lot of people in Washington want to talk about how that's Obama's fault. It's not Obama's fault. It's Putin's fault.
Corey Shockey, consolidate the change, David Ignatius says. But Vladimir Putin in Moscow today calling the political events we have seen in the Ukraine over the last couple of weeks a coup d'etat, and saying that Yanukovych is still the legal leader of Ukraine. Can this change be consolidated if Russia doesn't acknowledge or accept it, and they've got troops, not in Kiev, but certainly in Ukraine and Crimea, under a Russian leader who's not accepting the basic change, at least so far, on the ground in Kiev?
Yeah, you're sure right that ramps up the degree of difficulty. But I agree with David's point that we have a Putin problem, but we also have a Ukraine problem. And helping Ukrainians solve the Ukraine problem by preparation for elections, by helping stabilize their immediate economic crisis, by tying the assistance that we in the West are going to provide them to measures of good governance that will help get rid of the scourge of corruption that has been so damaging in Ukraine. Those kinds of things are good in and of themselves and help separate Putin's bad behavior and his alarming behavior from what's good for Ukraine. On the Putin front, I think he's making, as David has pointed out in his columns, he's making a short-term set of choices that are very aggressive, and our best policy moves are to make him pay a long-term price for that. And part of making him pay a long-term price for that is a Ukraine that doesn't remain a kleptocracy and a Russian satellite. I also think that pressure is going to come from NATO member states for a revision of the deal when they were admitted in the Clinton administration and in the Bush administration, a revision of the deal that said we see no reason to permanently station troops on the territory of new NATO members, because Poland, the Baltic states, Romania, Bulgaria are going to be quite alarmed by what the Russians have done, and quietly, privately sending a message to Putin that if you persist in this behavior, there are actually going to be consequences you're not going to like, and those consequences are very long-term for Russia.
Let me ask you, Corey, you say the U.S. and Europe should make Russia pay a long-term price for all this. Does that mean a return to Cold War? When you talk about a long-term price, it sounds like it could.
Well, I don't actually think Russia's in a position. They are no longer a superpower. In fact, one of the most important things we could do for Ukraine is find ways to substitute for the oil and gas that Russia is now threatening to cut off or dramatically raise the prices to. Russia, 75% of the Russian economy is oil and gas, and they are using it as a big blunt hammer to hit the Ukrainians with. As U.S. oil and gas increases, as Libyan oil and gas becomes an alternative, we ought really actually to press the Russians in a way that will emphasize to Putin and the circle around him that they are actually not the Soviet Union of 1956. The Russia of 2013 is actually a weak state behaving badly.
David Ignatius, Vladimir Putin appeared, I must say, unfazed by Western threats of consequences in his long, hour-long or more, freestyle press conference today in Moscow, angry at the characterization by the West, laid blame for what happened in Ukraine on the United States. He said the U.S. had interfered in Ukraine, quoting him here, quote, from across the pond in America, as if they were sitting in a laboratory and running experiments on rats without any understanding of the consequences. This does not sound like a Russian leader who is cowed by Western or American threats at this point. Where do you see the main American/European leverage in this picture to the extent it's there, David?
Well, I think Corey did a terrific job in summarizing the ways over the medium and long term that the U.S. and Europe can make Putin pay a price. The only thing I'd add is Putin desperately wants legitimacy for his Russia. You could see that in every moment of the Sochi Olympics. This hunger to be taken seriously as a strong country again, and I do think that the invasion of Crimea, rather than demonstrating real Russian strength, will, especially as it rolls forward, underline the weakness of Putin's position. And I think it's good U.S. policy to reinforce that, to demonstrate it, as Corey said, to show that far from securing your near abroad, your borders, this is going to lead to actions by NATO, by the countries surrounding you, that will leave Russia less in control, not more. I'd also caution about Putin's statements today. Today, so far, what we see is a crisis that's in a holding pattern that has not escalated to the next step. This is a very dangerous crisis. So, when you have a day in which you don't have an additional ratcheting up of tensions, it's important to note that. Also, the fact that Putin is insisting that what he's done, he hasn't done. It's a way, in a sense, of maintaining the illusion. He's recognizing that what he's accused of doing and has in fact done is something that the world rejects. And so he's saying, oh, no, we haven't done that. It's really America's fault. So I didn't see his statement today in quite such defiant terms as you did. And this crisis, we'll see hour by hour and day by day precisely how he plays his hand. The U.S. has to be ready to meet escalation, but also ready to see and respond appropriately to an attempt to de-escalate.
We're looking at what the U.S. should do or not do about Russia and Ukraine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Bill in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Bill, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Dangerous indeed. The serious consequences in Ukraine reminds me very much of the red line in Syria. And ironically, we arguably owe Putin a debt of gratitude for getting us off the red line hook. Europe, in addition to Ukraine, is critically dependent upon Russian natural gas. If we start playing an economic war with Russia, very quickly he's going to start talking about a 10 or a 15% reduction in natural gas to Europe, which will throw their economy into chaos. To me, we should offer assistance. We should offer to mitigate any or to officiate any kind of compromise, and then quietly get in line behind either the EU or NATO and let them take the lead on this. They're the ones that have the most to lose.
A compromise, meaning would you say, fine, Russia, leave your troops in Crimea? That's fine by Washington?
I think Washington should back off from its bluster and let the Europeans negotiate this. The Russians are not going to give up their deep, their Black Sea port. That's not going to happen. If they can take some sort of, make it into independent state, or if they can, that's just not going to be given up.
Bill, let us pick it up. Corey Shockey, David Ignatius talks about Russia's weakness here, but right now, you know, it's their troops in Crimea calling the shots at this point. They've got energy leverage over Europe. Is Russia really in such a vulnerable situation here, Corey?
Yeah, I actually think they are. You know, several years ago, the Russians played hardball with the Ukrainians by dramatically increasing the price of oil and gas. And Western Europeans very judiciously understood that they were vulnerable because 40% of their energy comes from Russia. And in the space, in that intervening time, they diversified their oil and gas imports in Europe and reduced Russia's share to 20%. They also have stockpiles to get them through the remainder of this year. So Europeans have time to play with on this. They're not immediately vulnerable to Russian energy sanctions. And if Russia tries to impose that, that will actually further drive the diversification of Western European energy sources. There are a lot of new energy sources opening up, not least from our own United States, that if we make some solid legal and policy choices, we can actually supplant the dependence that the Europeans have. And that's a good thing to do. Europeans have made a smart set of choices there.
David, do you...
On the Black Sea fleet.
Yes, please. Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please, on the fleet. Yes, please.
On the fleet. The German chancellor actually had a terrific suggestion that she got Putin to agree to, which is the basis that the Russians are claiming that their military moves in Crimea have legitimacy is not actually the protection of their Black Sea fleet, but the protection of Russian-speaking people in Ukraine. And the German chancellor proposed the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which has actually, over the last 30 years, been quite critical of Russian moves in Europe, to have them send a fact-finding mission. This will determine whether, you know, Ukrainians of Russian heritage are actually at any risk of the kind Putin claims he's responding to. That's a very constructive near-term step to defuse this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what the U.S. should do or not do about Russia and Ukraine. On Friday, before those troops clearly went in from Russia, President Obama spoke out against any Russian military intervention in Ukraine. The President of the United States warning there would be consequences.
Just days after the world came to Russia for the Olympic Games, it would invite the condemnation of nations around the world. And indeed, the United States will stand with the international community in affirming that there will be costs for any military intervention in Ukraine.
There will be costs, said the president. Don't cross those lines, said White House spokesman Jay Carney, saying the U.S. was watching Russia's movements. This was Friday, before Russian troops were understood to be in there.
We are watching to see, as the secretary said, whether or not Russia is doing anything that might be crossing the line in any way. We strongly support Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty, and we expect other nations to do the same.
Now, here we are. It's Tuesday. Russian troops were told all over Crimea in Ukraine. Michael's calling from Ukraine, from Kiev in Ukraine. Michael, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm okay. What do you see from Kiev?
Well, I mean, the whole thing is really an incredible outrage after all the pain and suffering and the misery that Ukraine's gone through, at least in Kiev, with this whole revolt, trying to get rid of this, you know, the biggest criminal outside of Africa. Really, it wasn't so much an EU versus Russia thing, to have this happen is just stunning, and it really probably will kick Ukraine into to really serious economic collapse. I think this all stems really back from Yushchenko when he was trying to throw out the Black Sea Fleet, which he never really should have done, and the flirtation with NATO. You know, that I'm sure Putin was thinking about this then. You know, and this is the ultimate result that he's afraid the new government might do this similar kind of thing.
Michael, you're in Kiev. Let me ask you about what the United States ought to do at this point. Do you see Russia being constrained by concern about action by the United States, sanctions or anything else?
Well, you know, up to a point, yes. But they're doing this. They've done this. It's done. I mean, Crimea is really gone unless unless Ukraine wants to spend a lot of lives and whatever. And it just doesn't have the power really to dislodge the Russians. You know, it's just like Maidan. Once it's easy to occupy something, it's very hard to throw people out of it once they've done it. And they've been there for 200 years. They have this base. They have the sympathy of the majority of at least, you know, Sevastopolans, not really even Crimeans. You know, even in the East, the most people don't want to be part of Russia. You know, they might want to travel to Russia. They have friends there. They want easy travel and exchange and you know, whatever. But they don't want to be part of Russia because it's a different country. It's a much more authoritarian country, much more brutal. And unfortunately, the soldiers have a lot more experience in killing. You know, Ukrainians are more peaceful people, which is one of the things about Maidan that was so amazing. In any other country, they would have shot 1,000 people.
But again, do you think Russia is constrained by American threats of sanctions or consequences, Michael?
No, I mean, not in Crimea, no. I mean, you know, if Obama was serious, he should have sent a battle group into the Black Sea and cruised around Sevastopol and sent a couple of F-18s over Simferopol Parliament, you know, at Mach 1. I mean, that would have gotten Putin's attention. That's the only thing that gets his attention. He's like Yanukovych. He respects power, nothing else. And, you know, he thinks this is part of Russia. And historically, it was. And many of the people are you know, have Russian passports. Most of the people have Russian passports. But they've been doing this a while. They've been handing out passports like candy to people, which is like slow-motion subversion.
And then Vladimir Putin says he must protect those Russian speakers in Ukraine. Michael, calling from Kiev in Ukraine, I appreciate your call. I mean, the reaction in the United States to the White House handling of this has been across a pretty wide front here. A little tape from Fox News Sunday of Democrat Representative Chris Van Hollen, Maryland, saying Americans should be more worried about what Putin does than Obama, at least in the first hours of what's happened.
I think we're 48 hours into an international crisis. I would hope Americans would focus on condemning the actions of Putin rather than in knee-jerk way, again, criticizing the president of the United States. Let's stand together on this.
But Cory Shockey, I want to ask you here about your former boss in the 08 campaign, John McCain. He was talking yesterday in Washington to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, a Republican senator out of Arizona, saying the Obama administration has some responsibility for what Russia has now done in Ukraine. Here's McCain.
This is the ultimate result of a feckless foreign policy where nobody believes in America's strength anymore.
Cory Shockey, we hear a lot of that in the last few days. What about that line of criticism of the White House?
Well, I think we've heard a lot about that from more than the last few days. You know, Secretary Kerry wouldn't be on a global tour arguing that we're not withdrawing from the world if there wasn't significant concern about that by American allies. I think David Ignatius's column from a couple of days ago expressed it best, though, which is that the Obama administration has made some not particularly deft policy choices in the last several days, but that doesn't change where responsibility for this lies. It is an act of aggression by Vladimir Putin's forces in violation of the territorial integrity of Ukraine. And I do think that we ought not to remove focus from the fact that this is Putin's fault, not President Obama's fault.
David Ignatius, do you think Washington engineered this in some part, Putin says, by meddling in Kiev, in Ukraine? Did the White House invite this, by, as John McCain says, by looking feckless on the world stage?
Well, on the two issues, has the U.S. been meddling, been actively encouraging dissent and revolt in Kiev? The answer is that the U.S. has supported Ukrainians. Senator John McCain himself was in Kiev as these demonstrations were starting, and many American Deputy Secretary of State Bill Burns was in Kiev as well, saying to the Ukrainian people that your desire for a more legitimate, representative, a responsible government is a just one that the American people and to a limited extent the American government supports. The notion that this was a conspiracy, a kind of orange revolution manufactured in Washington, it's a misreading by Putin that's so basic that it calls into question how he looks at lots of things. On this larger question of feckless foreign policy, as Senator McCain put it. I think Corey and I agree that the two points that have to be made here. The first is that this president does have a credibility problem around the world. That was true before the Ukraine events began. It's true now. It's one that needs to be addressed, but in a careful way. I mean, the idea that a president is getting hammered to take action, show you're tough, in the middle of a very, very dangerous and delicate international crisis, I think that's worrisome. So the response, the way in which you reinforce U.S. power, credibility, staying power, needs to be done carefully over months, not in the space of a few hours or days. But that's not to say that the issue isn't there. As I look at the actions that are underway, so the very fact that Secretary Kerry is in Kiev, but the specific package he's bringing, and the ways in which the U.S. is working with allies to deal with the fundamentals of this crisis. It seems to me to be a pretty reasonable package. Again, it needs to be sustained. A year from now, we need to be looking at how the U.S. is shaping its policy to deal with Putin and just to see whether Putin has understood that there are limits on what he can do in his neighborhood.
Corey, does the United States have to signal to Vladimir Putin here that Washington understands that the Russian naval bases will stay in Crimea? Is that the minimum price for resolving this?
Well, I'm not sure, to be honest, Tom. It seems to me that one of the mistakes that the president has made is to be lecturing Vladimir Putin in public and in vague terms on what Russian national interests should be. That strikes me as the kind of thing that Vladimir Putin will take as condescending and also worth testing. And instead, I haven't heard any Americans suggest that Russian naval bases need to be thrown out of Ukraine. But I do think a private conversation with Russians that Ukrainians might think that if you continue to behave this way is a useful conversation to have in private with the Russians.
Let's go to Natasha calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Natasha, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm well. What do you see, Natasha?
I had a suggestion, just a little background. I've been in the United States for over 20 years, and I'm originally from St. Petersburg, Russia. I'm quarter Ukrainian, and I'm very much hoping that Ukraine will continue with its independence and become part of European Union. But the suggestion is, with John Kerry being in Ukraine now, I really hope he can advise the new Ukrainian government on passing as soon as possible some laws that will send a very clear message to the Russian population in Ukraine that they will be included in the new Ukrainian government, they will be protected, that if they will ever be attacked by anybody, those people who attack them will be persecuted. I'm talking about the civil attacks, not the Russian army there, but anybody on the streets, any kind of, as they call, ultra-nationalists or anti-Semites or whoever else there, fascists supposedly, that if anybody attacks Russian population, they'll be protected, that they will have a right to study their language. Thank God they the Ukrainian government withdrew that law that they proposed recently when they first came to power, that Russian won't be allowed to study. Russian population needs to feel secure, and then they might start considering feeling comfortable to be part of the new Ukrainian state and part of the European Union. Visa rights are very important to them. A lot of them have businesses in both Ukraine and Russia, and they want to have that possibility to move freely between Russia and Ukraine.
Now, Natasha, we've got it. You sound very smart and very plugged in. I really appreciate your call. Those are smart suggestions. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. David Ignatius, Natasha has a good finger feel for this. Move quickly to legislate some kind of comforting laws to give Russian speakers in Ukraine a sense that they're not under threat. That sounds wise, David.
I thought what Natasha said was very smart. The Ukrainian government needs to do now what it has really failed to do since independence, which is to build a stable platform to find ways for the rule of law to stop the theft of Ukrainian assets by oligarchs, to reassure Russian speakers and Ukrainian speakers that they're part of the same country and that there are going to be protections for them, to help Ukrainians across the country look west, find their future in economic, political, other ties with Europe, even as they hold on to their Russian heritage. I mean, I think that balanced Ukraine is what Secretary Kerry hopefully is trying to begin to construct today. And I thought Natasha's comment was exactly right on. Somebody should send it to Kerry's plane.
But Khrushchev, what if Vladimir Putin saying today that this whole thing has been a coup d'etat, that Yanukovych is still the legitimate leader of Ukraine? What if Russia moves to upend the whole thing? They're just not going to accept it. I mean, people have said if this reform succeeds in Ukraine, it becomes a threat to Russia's, Putin's, whole system.
I do think there's a serious risk of that, Tom. I think the reason that Putin has been so bombastic about Ukraine is that Yanukovych's fate is exactly what he fears being his fate, which is a kleptocracy that the public gets exasperated with and refuses to comply with government, with a created fiction of governance. And so Putin's fearful that Yanukovych's fate is going to be his own, and he should be, frankly.
One more call here. Abilene, Texas. TR is calling. TR, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I was trying to comment upon the point you made that America has a responsibility to be there. I think, yes, America does have a moral and a political responsibility to uphold the democratic institutions, the rule of law across the world. If America does not step up to the plate, which other nation has the wherewithal and the willingness to do that? We have to protect the rule of law across the democratic institutions of the world. If you just give a free hand here, what is going to happen in China there? They're going to bully the same thing there. No, we have to do that. We have to step up to the plate.
TR, I appreciate your call, and it's funny that you raised China. I mean, if Vladimir Putin succeeds here, one can imagine China looking at those disputed islands that it's fighting with Japan over rhetorically so far, even looking at Taiwan and saying, well, the U.S. is just going to make deals. But still, David Ignatius, I don't know how far the U.S. is going to go here. We don't have any guarantee at this point that Putin's really going to back off. And if he doesn't, is the Europe really going to get hand in hand with the United States in creating a united front here? There's some sounds out of Europe already that sound more like acceptance than resistance.
I think there are two points to make. The first is that the policy the U.S. is shaping basically is one to deny legitimacy to Russia's attempt, it seems, to annex Crimea militarily. The U.S. has offered a way out, saying, you can restore the status quo ante with international monitors there to guarantee the rights of Russian speakers in the Crimea. But as long as Putin doesn't back down, we're not going to send in the fleet, but the U.S. won't accept the legitimacy of what's happening. On the question of Europe, it's obvious that the U.S. needs to lead, that the if we wait for the Europeans to take leadership here, we'll be waiting a year from now, and it still won't have happened. So that's why it's a good thing that Kerry's in Kyiv today.
Events still in a whirl there. We will be following, but terrific perspective from both of you today. David Ignatius at The Washington Post, thank you very much for coming on with us today, David. Good to hear from you.
Thank you, Tom.
And Corey Shockey, research fellow these days at the Hoover Institution. Corey, thank you so much for your thoughts today.
It's been a pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.